Welcome back to the second session of this seminar. Professor Alan Zelak currently works at the Department of Civil Procedure, the Faculty of Law, University of Cyber. He will present to us a paper about new age, old issues, taking of evidence between paternalistic inquisitorialism and passive communities. Thank you.
Thank you, Diego. Starting with the delay, and I would like to, with your permission, to stand up to see you better and to have this outside pressure on me to speak shorter, because I see the discussion here is very important. My first introductory remark is that I really appreciate being here and think that Girona has established itself as a very exciting place, and the chair for legal culture is currently a very, well, I would say a vibrant place, which is noted in different sides of Europe and the world, and I'm therefore very glad to be in this also exciting project of establishing a new journal, and my thanks go in particular to Jordi and to Edgar as those who are most responsible for making it possible. Now, again, all of my presentations here need to have a disclaimer, and I'm going to repeat it once again. My main area of expertise and research is civil procedure. I see many of you being active in the area of criminal justice. However, my firm belief is that civil procedure, criminal procedure, administrative procedure, when it comes to common issues like evidence, do share and do have a lot in common, although we always need to take into account their special needs and special views, but generally I hope this is going to be relevant. And when I was invited to speak here, I found inspiration in two things. First of all, I will tell you a little bit about another exciting project which Remco and I were a part of in the past 5 years, and therefore I wanted to connect our work in one area with my appearance here. And the second inspiration that I had for my speech today was actually the very successful conference which was held in Girona last, was it June? Yeah, I think it was in June 2018. Where the first lecture was provided again, to my great satisfaction, but by a civil proceduralist, namely Adrian Zuckerman from Oxford, and I was very much eager to listen to him. And when I have heard his speech, I thought, well, I disagree with so many things in this speech that I think I should at some time say or write something about it. So, you will see whether it's relevant or not a little bit later in my speech. But Paul, in the end of his presentation, stated that all our discussions are in the end as much as important as they have a bearing on the real life of law and as much as they have some influence on legal practice. So I'm going to start where Paul ended, and I'm going to place my discussion in the context of, I see new age and old issues, of something that has been important both in the old age and nowadays, and this is the idea that legal system needs to be improved and that it needs to be reformed. And, what were seen to be the principal threats to contemporary justice systems, and civil justice is in particular what I had in mind, but I think it applies at least partially to criminal justice as well. In the second half of the 20th century, or at the end of 80s and in the 90s, I think that the best summary was given by a English colleague, a member of the International Association of Procedural Law, but also an English lord, Jack Jacob, who in several of his speeches referred to a three-headed hydra, I see that we have Hydra for the second time, then we have many heads, but now the three-headed Hydra, which he was pointing to, was the Hydra which had heads of delays, costs, and vexation. And effectively, we can really see that legal systems, and seemingly, well, English was one among the first to say it very loudly, but this has been the principal topic of reforms also in continental Europe and the principal problems in continental Europe. And therefore, fundamental debates in procedural law were centered around these principal problems. Now, where is the solution? Where to go? Well, we spoke a lot about truth, about systems. One solution which became popular as a way of phrasing the problem is, again, fundamentally English, because it's connected to a word which is very difficult to translate to some other languages. And this word is case management. So case management has actually become a notion which has currently been discussed in a number of places. And I most recently had an opportunity to go to Chile and speak about European approach to case management, but that was the principal topic of a large Latin American conference. So what is case management? Just like the notion of truth, case management is also multifaceted and, ambiguous in its use. And I was searching for some way to explain this notion. Browsing through my files, I found one where a good colleague of mine, sometimes knowledgeable colleague, Professor Van Rey, has explained to students in Zagreb the notion of case management, because the Netherlands was, capturing this wave of reforms and was among the first countries to actually also introduce techniques. And what did he say? What were his words? So he said that case management is describing a system of rules of civil procedure which do not prescribe a uniform procedural framework for each and every case, but differentiate between different types of cases. And these are the rules of civil procedure which have to leave the judge the necessary discretion to manage individual cases and the caseload as a whole. And this discretion can only be exercised to reach certain well-defined goals such as timeliness, moderate costs and efficiency. And finally, in order to make it work, courts have to be provided with adequate resources in order to create an environment where highly qualified court staff manage cases efficiently. I could probably simplify this definition. It was a very learned definition, by simply saying that it is a system which prescribes good procedural rules for typical cases with sufficient discretion used for the common goals by a well-organized and competent judiciary. Now, my point here is not to enter in depth into this definition, but I want to argue that case management nowadays has actually taken a systemic place in the modern discussion, which was once upon held by other notions. And the two notions which I'm in particular here going to address are the notions of adversarial and inquisitorial systems. Nowadays, speaking about improving the operation of the system of justice, it's very difficult to use, and what I'm going to submit to you, it is also misleading to use the notions of adversarial and inquisitorial system. So, while for some of you this might be an old news, and in particular. I don't think that many people nowadays speak about desirable models, but still, I think it's relevant to know that adversarial and inquisitorial notions are popping up every now and then in a way which is not useful, and they often get abused in order to promote particular agenda which are not necessarily in order or in line with the good administration of justice. Now, this criticism of adversarial and inquisitorial models is not a new one. In fact, another book published in 1985, The Faces of Justice and the State Authority, the book by my fellow countryman, well, person from Zagreb, Professor Mirjan Damaška, argued at length that the inquisitorial adversarial divide is not appropriate as the model for even explaining a legal system. So what did he try to do? He made his own model based on a different division. And I will not go into details here. I will focus here on debate which uses adversarial and inquisitorial models as examples of desirable or not desirable models of contemporary judicial process. And essentially, my intention is to ask what model of judicial procedure is universally better from that perspective, and show that this cannot be used as the real device. So the questions that I'm going to ask is the opposition between adversarial and inquisitorial models still useful as a tool for scholars and legislators? And I will address in particular two issues here, trying to test the possible ways how to evaluate these systems, the strengths and weaknesses of the systems, in terms that are compatible to what is now being recognized as the main problems in a judicial system, namely, which of the two models is more efficient in terms of speed, costs, and efforts, and which of the two models produces more accurate results. This is something that I prefer over speaking about truth, but okay, we can speak also about the quality of the process. Indeed, what we have to start with is to look a little bit into the main features of this binary model that distinguishes adversarial and inquisitorial processes, because this has also been in practical use rather differently defined. So the adversarial process and inquisitorial process, at least how I understand them on the basis of a number of approaches, and I think this is probably the simplest way to put it, are defined by the idea about the role of the main participants in that process, being on one side the parties and their lawyers, and the other side the court or the judge. And the notion of adversarial process as a pure model assumes that in such a process we have a passive judge and active parties. How active? Well, very active. In a pure adversarial model, the masters of litigation, the domini litis, are the parties. And this then transposes into technical elements of the process. So some of the most popular technical elements associated with an adversarial process are, for instance, cross-examination or discovery, or duty of mutual disclosure in the fact-finding process. Also, in such a system, every element necessary for substantive adjudications, or adjudication on the merits, is put to the court by the parties, who also bear the burden for proving it, and this includes also the obligation to plead the law and also prove the law of the case. Inquisitorial process, on the other hand side, is a process where you have a different distribution of roles. This is a process in which judges or the court are the act, an active element, whereas the parties in the end may even become an, the object and not the subject of the proceedings. In such a process, there is an obligation to seek for true facts and applicable law on the side by the court, and the burden for these establishments is also on the side of the court. We can see that in respect of all elements, not only proof, not only facts, but also the applicable law, according to the principle jura novit curia, or the judge knows the law, needs to be established exclusively by the court. Do we have pure models in reality? Well, historically, probably the closest matches to these models of process were, on one hand side, the Roman canonical civil procedure, the procedure which was prevailing up to the 19th century in Europe, and which was replaced later by different models of procedure. Inquisitorial process, on the other hand side, also is difficult to find in its pure form, but for instance, socialist civil procedure was getting very close to that model, and indeed, when we speak about criminal procedure, although I will show you in a moment that it's not uncontroversial, but according to this definition, it would be a inquisitorial process of a extreme kind. Now, I would like to address some paradoxes of that occur in such an understanding and distinction of models. And I will start with some paradoxes. First, some preliminary paradoxes. And this is a paradox that, it's, that, that occurs because it is virtually impossible to experimentally see what the effects of a particular system are, which one is more effective or which one is more accurate, because the perfect systems and models at present do not exist. All the present systems are in a way a mixture of different elements, and even the noted historical examples do depart from pure models in some essential aspects. Next, also preliminary paradox here, maybe in the nature of self-understanding of individual national systems. As the historical discussion often associated inquisitorial processes to old, medieval, inefficient system, it was rather unpopular to describe your own national system as an inquisitorial one. Therefore, it was a little bit refreshing to hear Paolo yesterday speaking about his national system as inquisitorial, which again is a frank description and probably more accurate one if we accept these definitions. But not everybody is so frank. So for instance, the principal ideologist of the Soviet Russia, Andrei Yanuarevich Vyshinsky, the prosecutor in Stalinist cases, it was also a legal theorist. And well, what he claimed against some other legal theorist, it was very, very dangerous to be the opponent of Vyshinsky, because Vyshinsky, when he was not satisfied with the responses, usually followed with pragmatic action, and some of his principal discussants like Stuchka and Pashukanis actually in the end didn't finish up very nicely. So we should all be careful what we are saying as legal theories, because it may, even being a legal theorist may in some settings be a rather dangerous thing. But to get back to this, it's interesting that, Vyshinsky was arguing that Soviet criminal process is in effect an adversarial one. And he said, it's much nicer to try, sentence and punish the enemies of the Soviet system in a public process where they are going to fight and where all our citizens will see who real enemy is of the system, and this will have also a pronounced educational note and will help the citizens to bring forward further claims about actions that are against national interests. So definitely, sometimes we have to distinguish what the system thinks about itself and how it is actually constructed. I can tell it from my own student experience, because the textbook of civil procedure, which I had to learn from and later also examine students, argued that Croatian or former Yugoslav civil procedure is dominantly adversarial civil procedure. Whereas, on the other hand, according to the elements that we have already seen, indeed, no cross-examination, some inquisitorial powers in finding facts, and the overall approach of procedure was a procedure in which the parties were the passive element and the court had at least theoretically a passive role, an active role. And I will tell a little bit about that later. But these are just the preliminary paradoxes. There are further paradoxes linked to the understanding of effects of the two models and the direction of procedural reforms. So let us start with the two tests that I announced, and this is: what is the most efficient model of procedure? Is it inquisitorial or is it adversarial? And we will not have a doctrinal or theoretical text. We will see how systems reacted. So what we can note is that in the 2000s, in the past two decades, there were two parallel developments, and these two developments had the opposing direction. So on one hand side, in a number of Western European countries, starting with England and Wales, Wolf reforms, for instance, in the area of civil procedure, but also then elsewhere, gradually, the addressing of the principal problems, speed, cost, vexation, was addressed by strengthening inquisitorial elements, by strengthening the activity of the court, strengthening the obligation of the court in the process. On the other side, in Eastern European countries, also Central European countries and Southern, their way of addressing legal reforms was going into quite the other way. They aimed to speed up trials by abolishing inquisitorial powers of the judge. So, for instance, again, I will just limit my remarks to the second model. There was a perception that the cause of inefficiency of the process is in too broad inquisitorial powers of the judge, and that this then consequently leads to changes that are necessary, which in the end also resulted in removing the powers that existed before. I have written about this phenomenon in a text under the title Omnipotent Judges as the Cause of Impotence and Inefficiency, where I described how this process was advancing. But let's go to the other test, and this is the test of accuracy, because here we are focusing on fact-finding and evidence. What model of process does guarantee better results? Is inquisitorial style of proceedings more effective than adversarial, or vice versa, whether the adversarial is better than inquisitorial? Here too, we can note in the past two decades two parallel developments that go in different direction. For instance, common law countries still believe that, or at least, well, I will see by your reactions whether it is the case, but believe that adversarial techniques, especially cross-examination, are vital for truth-finding or accuracy of the process. And on the other side, continental doctrine believes that some ex officio powers and active involvement of judges in taking of evidence are the necessary precondition of accuracy. We can find various examples for these positions. So, for instance, first the traditional view, you all know about the Wigmore's statement about cross-examination being the greatest legal engine ever invented for discovery of truth. And, well, whole books were written about that. Cox, for instance, stated that cross-examination is the rarest, the most useful, and the most difficult to be acquired of all accomplishments of the advocate, because it has always been deemed the surest test of truth and the better scrutiny than the oath, traditional position. But interestingly, that's not just the historical position. In his speech delivered last year in Girona, Zuckerman argued that adversarial process is the only guarantee of integrity of a judicial process. And his position was that this is structurally a precondition for accurate fact-finding. And the argument that he advanced was that the inquisitorial system has inbuilt biases, especially the confirmation bias, which cannot actually lead to accurate results. So, is this the case? Maybe there is some truth in this statement, but there are completely different views on accuracy of adversarial systems, and indeed we in continental Europe tend to think that our systems are superior, but I'm referring to a important and often cited text by a American law professor from Yale, John Langbein, who argued in his famous paper on the German advantage in civil procedure that German civil procedure with all its features is very superior to adversarial system, which is distorting evidence, which is expensive, and which is very far from actual ideal truth finding. German model with its moderated, balanced way, with its approach that enables judges to moderate the zealousness of the advocates, according to Langbein, is in this sense very superior. Let me get back to Zuckerman's argument about cognitive biases. So what is what the science says today? Indeed, the cognitive biases do exist, and they exist in the form of confirmation bias, but not only in that form. This is just a list of some of the forms of biases that you can find in everyday discourse, but also in judicial decision making. Ego depletion, the phenomenon that thorough analytical decision making actually takes glucose out of our brain and therefore requires more power, and therefore is something that is in reasoning easily replaced by cognitive cues, as stated, by simple making on the basis of assumptions that are sometimes true and sometimes not. Anchoring effect, when decision maker is in doubt and he has even a random figure that is put to his attention, that random figure is affecting his decision making. Hindsight bias, if something has happened, then you are more likely to believe that it was probable that it would happen, and this then affects your evaluation of past behavior, which is very often in law. And of course, egocentric bias, which is a bias natural in all decision makers. We all think that we are above average in our capacities and superior in our ability to draw conclusions. Anyway, what we can conclude is that juridical and judicial decision making is, in fact, in all models of procedure, less rational and deductive than assumed in conventional textbooks of, I think, both criminal and civil procedure. What judges are often applying are cognitive shortcuts, rules of thumb, and this has been confirmed by concrete empirical evidence in the research that has tested whether judges also suffer from all series of biases that are listed here. So therefore, cognitive biases do exist and play a role irrespective of the model of judicial process, whether it's an adversarial or inquisitorial model. So my submission is to that it is wrong to associate particular quality to a particular model and use inquisitorial and adversarial notions in a kind of beauty contest between legal systems. What we instead need to do is to focus on the model that divides procedures and see also whether this model is still useful or has to be replaced by something else. There are two assumptions on which this division of adversarial and inquisitorial processes are rooted, and I would submit that both are fundamentally false. First, it is that passive and active behavior or passive and active action in the process of the judge and the parties is a kind of a zero-sum game. Or, to be very clear, passive judges necessarily imply that parties are active, or on the other side, active judges assume that parties are passive. What we have here is a kind of a seesaw. And I would say that this view is fundamentally wrong. The second assumption is that in respect to processing of procedural material, the judges and parties are bound to be either passive or active in respect to the same issues. And what that assumes is that the behavior and the powers of the court and judges regarding the obligation to find facts, when we speak about evidence, ex officio, is necessarily then combined with judicial activism in the conduct of the process. And this is another assumption which I hold to be wrong. I'll give some examples. First, let me start with the second assumption. We have models of actual civil procedural processes where you have both passive court and passive parties. And I will tell you where we can see that. But the activity and passivity also has to be seen in particular when it comes to the way of case management, well, type of case management. And here, case management can be divided into substantive and formal case management. And substantive and formal case management are directed towards different objectives. The substantive case management includes the steps undertaken in order to define facts relevant to the determination of the dispute, to identify and present evidence necessary for the a proper determination of the facts, to determine applicable rules of law, and to identify and apply other rules necessary for decision making on the merits of the case. So these are all actions directly relevant for substantive decision making. Whereas formal case management defines the formal conduct of the proceedings. These are the steps undertaken, and here we have a number of things listed: setting procedural calendars, scheduling meetings and conferences with the parties, setting deadlines, determining the type of procedure, and so on. In respect, even when it only comes to evidence and facts, the division of labor here exists between the court and the parties, but not in a way that one is responsible for everything and the other is passive, but here, instead of active and passive behavior, it is a functional division of labor, where both parties and the court are active in a certain way. Now, most reforms with respect to formal case management today tried to emphasize the active role of the court. So even in the adversarial systems, nowadays you have the strong movement towards increasing the obligations of the court to conduct and control the proceedings. Let me now go into another issue, and this is whether we have further empirical support for advantages of adversarial or inquisitorial systems. And here I will assume together with you that if adversarial system is superior, then it should also be reflected in the opinion of the users of particular system. Interestingly, today we have sufficient empirical information about what citizens and businesses think about their systems of justice. So, for instance, in the European Union, we can trace the opinion of the users in the document that is called the EU Justice Scoreboard, and which is published now 2 or 3 years ago, well, since 2016, on the annual basis. And a number of facts and figures are collected in such a document. One figure is in particular relevant for us, and this is the indication of the public trust in the judiciary. This is, for instance, the results of the survey of public in respect whether the public holds courts and judges to be independent or not. And I would say that this is also the indicator of reliability and the public trust into particular national systems. What can we see in this slide? Well, what we can see is that in over half of the EU countries, a half or more of population do not trust the independence of judiciary. Where do we have high trust and where do we have a low trust in judiciary? What we see here, for instance, is that the highest trust in Europe is in Denmark. Denmark, Finland, and Austria hold the first three places. And this is indicated by this blue column, which reflects the responses to the question whether you hold that independence of courts and judges is good or bad. So blue means very good or fairly good. And here, consistently in last years, Denmark and Finland, the public trust, well, in Denmark is almost 90%, and Finland over 80%. Similarly, also in Austria, Sweden. And then we have Ireland, Germany, Netherlands, Luxembourg, United Kingdom, Belgium, and Cyprus. What do we have on the other side? Well, thing that I'm not proud of is that my country is at the very end. Croatia has the lowest perceived trust in judiciary, which is shown by this column here, which is also unfortunately decreasing from year to year. And this shows that currently about, almost 80% of population do not trust the independence, or I would say also judiciary, as do not appreciate judiciary as such. What are the other countries? Croatia, Slovakia, Bulgaria, Estonia, Italy, Poland, Slovenia, Romania, Portugal, Hungary, Lithuania, Latvia, Czech Republic, This was Spain. And this is Estonia. EE is Estonia. Malta, Greece, and France. Can we draw any conclusions from this public opinion on legal systems as to which system is better, an adversarial or inquisitorial one? Even in a very moderate way, if we assume that some systems are more adversarial and more inquisitorial than the other systems. And I would say that it's hardly the case. Well, first of all, some of the most adversarial ones are at best here in the middle. Austria is hardly an example, at least in civil procedure, of a radical adversarial system. It is true that what we have here on this side is a number of Eastern and Southern European systems which used to be rather inquisitorial, but interestingly, what was happening in the recent past is that these traditional inquisitorial systems have undertaken reforms which have swung them completely into the other camp. So very radical adversarial models, at least when we speak about civil procedure. So I don't think that we have any good empirical evidence here about this. And specifically when it comes to the experience of post-socialist development, that the Berlin Wall fell in the beginning of the 90s, and we have already two decades after that. The traces of Soviet doctrine are still visible. What was the basis of the ideological base of inquisitorialism in the socialist countries? Again, we start with the fundamental ideological or philosophical rule is correspondence theory of truth that we already referred to. And what does it mean? Correspondence with the outside reality is the ultimate criterion of accuracy. You have the objective reality which is existing outside of the proceedings. It's very important, and actually most important, to come to conclusions which are complying to that outside reality. There is a supremacy of truth as the values in judicial process. It is the pinnacle in the hierarchy of procedural principles. And therefore, the overarching goal of every judicial process is material truth. That is die materielle Wahrheit in German, which it, at least in German and Austria was used in a different context in the debate of legal and free systems of evaluation of evidence. But here it means a correspondence to the objective truth. So the aim of the process is to mirror the reality, and the reality is as such ideologically construed. The ultimate criterion is transprocedural truth which exists outside of the courtroom. Political underpinning is clear. You need to have a process which is instrumental to the goals of the system. Therefore, formal law and formal criteria, legal truth, they all have to be decomposed. Material truth should be the alibi for purging the court proceedings of all harmful and unnecessary formalism. This is a citation from, again, one of the textbooks according to which I learned at my law school. Judicial process needs to have an educational role, therefore. It has to manage relationships of parties without unnecessary mediators. So, for instance, lawyers as such, in fact, any private influence and element is not viewed as desirable. Therefore, the parties need to submit their case to the court, which is then evaluated by the criteria of, again, traditional criteria, free evaluation of evidence. But free evaluation of evidence was the evidence, again, citation based on class instincts, socialist consciousness, dialectic materialism, and democratic centralism. Therefore, the state needs to intervene in all elements of the process, in all legal relations, and insofar, even Lenin was arguing that there is no difference between private law and public law. In the socialist law, all law is public because it has public consequences, and the ultimate arbiter is the political convenience, the opinion of the ruling elites in the socialist period. It was the ruling party. Now, what is the experience after this development? So, how to put it in terms of inquisitorial and adversarial? So, as we have seen in the socialist period, we had a paternalistic inquisitorial attitude towards the process. The activity seemed to be ideologically assigned only to the court, whereas the parties were supposed to be passive. And the ideological objectives were also imposed on the court, and they were regarded to be much more important than individual right. And especially, it was more important to reach the truth than to reach a result within a reasonable time or any time at all. And therefore, what is turned into practice is that such inquisitorial process effectively was a process of reactive nature. Collection of evidence was the ultimate responsibility of the court. The burden of proof on the parties was virtually lifted and eliminated. And because the truth was so important, there was lack of any limitation in the process. The preclusions did not play any role, so whatever was raised, even if it was raised knowingly only in the late stages of proceedings, had to be considered by the court, because the court had to establish the truth. Even facts raised on appeal had to be evaluated. Well, even the facts which were abusively raised only at appeal had to be taken into account. Therefore, the res judicata effect was construed, again, I'm not speaking about some moderate systems, like Yugoslav was rather moderate, but in for instance, even now in China, res judicata virtually does not exist, because the parties can always reopen the procedure, asking to have it re-examined in the light of new facts. You can see here how effectively very scientific Chinese civil procedure is, because in science, as we all know, there is no ultimate deadline for finding the truth, and therefore, well, also in Chinese procedure, there is no such ultimate deadline. But what is the consequence in practice? We have a model of process where we have passive court and passive judges, because, well, although there was an ideological urge to collect material, the judges were, in fact, not really armed with adequate tools. Just like in any other process, even judges were under strict ideological control, and their interest into finding the facts, into collecting material, was from their own natural perspective very low. Because if you find all facts, you have to make a decision. And decision may be unfavorable to somebody who is in charge of defining what objective truth is, somebody who is staying outside of procedure. So therefore, it's much better to lead the procedure reactively, collect material with huge delays, and this is in fact what happens, massive inefficiency, delays, and backlogs. Was it the more truthful system? Definitely not. Because, well, if you need about 5 or 10 years in the first instance to come to the judgment, which may then be reviewed on appeal, and then eventually in a couple of decades you will have another review, for the sheer passage of time, you will have less and less possibilities to find what really happened. Interestingly, in the post-socialist period, we have again a completely opposite situation, but with the same consequences. Especially in the countries where it was very clear, like Hungary or Poland, instantly in the 90s, the first reform said, we don't want to be inquisitorial anymore. We want to be very adversarial. And what did it mean the context of civil procedure? How it was understood? And it was actually misconceived in a way. Namely, the new goal in the procedure was not anymore to establish material, but legal truth. And that became the main slogan of the procedural reforms. We don't have to search for factual truth, we have to find what party's truth is in the process. And in order to facilitate that, strict deadlines have been imposed for presentation of facts and introduction of evidence, and if these strict deadlines were not observed, the consequence was that a fact or a piece of proof could not be considered or taken anymore, no matter whether it's relevant, important or not. And the court, in this sense, had very little discretion to allow it, and frankly didn't care, because it was much more elegant and comfortable for the court just to, well, say, this is the party's truth, you haven't raised a fact in due time, therefore, sorry. Adversarial evidence taking was therefore again turned into another reactive process. What happened was, if we exaggerate a little bit, was returned back to the 18th century, beginning of 9th century, where again a very adversarial procedure resulted in the necessity of the parties to plead all the possible, even hypothetically possible, facts at the very beginning. And therefore, they had also to accumulate their assertions under the procedural principle, which was in Germany called Eventualmaxime. Stating, for instance, we never concluded the contract with the other party, but if we concluded that contract, this contract is invalid because we never saw that party. But if we did see that party, we never met on that date. If we met on that date, we never considered this fact. So, effectively, with the reintroduction of this accumulation, the consequence was that a lot of unnecessary material started to enter the court dockets. Consequence, finally, was that the courts and parties were overburdened, a lot of appeals, and further inefficiency. Again, accuracy is hardly to be evaluated as high. So what should be a modern approach to civil procedure then? And now I will speed up because I think my time is now more or less over. The project in which Remco and I participated in the last 5 years tried to phrase this a modern approach. And it was a project based on a document that already in the beginning of 2000s was produced by American Law Institute and UNIDRA, document called Principles of Transnational Civil Procedure. And some of you may know this document. Several scholars from different systems participated in that project. Some of the most visible ones were Professor Jeffrey Hazard on the American side, and Michele Taruffo and Rolf Stürner from German and Italian side. Later also Antonio Giri from Brazil. And well, for us is in a particular important the Rule 11, which was supposed to define the obligation of the parties and lawyers. But this rule is relatively short, and the whole set of rules, and in fact called principles, were rather general. So a new project was initiated in 2013 by European Law Institute, again in collaboration with UNIDRA, where these principles had to be converted in a more comprehensive document, which could even be used as model legislation, the example of best practices for Europe. And this project was supposed to be the follow-up to the original ALI and UNIDRA project. Now, the project of European Law Institute was in its participation much more comprehensive. More people participated. There were a lot of working groups, I think 9 or 10, Remco, 10 working groups. But the one relevant for us today is the working group on obligations of parties and lawyers. And that was the group that Remco and I had the honor of chairing as co-reporters. So what we started with was the Rule 11, and I will cite our introductory explanation of what we finally produced. Well, we wanted to produce rules which create a modern approach to civil litigation, in that they put the emphasis on loyal cooperation between the judge, the parties, and the lawyers, creating the models where all of them have a shared responsibility in putting an end to dispute. And this means that adversarial inquisitorial divide is intentionally avoided, since the underlying idea is the rules is that there is no mutually exclusive division of labor between the various participants in a civil lawsuit. They are only shared obligations. Now, what we see here is a model of procedure where we don't have any more active parties, passive court, active parties, but a model in which all participants, parties, their lawyers, and the court are active. And thereby, this old conundrum of adversarial process and inquisitorial process is replaced by one sole procedural principle, the principle of loyal cooperation. In the latest variant of this text, which is supposed to be finalized in May next year, we have the Rule 2, general rule, which states exactly this: parties, their lawyers, and the courts must cooperate in order to promote fair, efficient, and speedy resolution of the dispute. I will more or less stop here just by drawing a couple of conclusions. First, I'd like to show you some of the rules which were later produced in the context of evidence. For instance, the general obligations of parties, lawyers, and the court are listed in the preliminary part, listing the obligations of the parties as in all segments of the process, but also on the other side mirrored by the shared obligation of the court. And for the sake of time, I'm not going to read and analyze this. Maybe you're also interested in the rules on facts, evidence, and applicable law, where we also have in the end variant the text where the model of procedure is neither adversarial nor inquisitorial according to the definition which we have given. So indeed, there is a joint and shared responsibility here. The court will generally support the facts from which were advanced by the parties. It must not consider facts not introduced by the parties, but it may consider such facts that are not specifically addressed if they are necessarily implied. It may only do so if relevant parties claim or defense, they are relevant to a party's claim or defense and the parties have been given a reasonable opportunity to respond. So there are also safeguards built into it. And again, when it comes to evidence, the right of the parties, well, parties are in the forefront, but the court also has exceptionally a possibility to take evidence on its own motion. Now, conclusions. Maybe it will be difficult to avoid binary principles, but they may be used with, as heuristic tools. They may have some heuristic value, but when it's used as a recipe for phrasing the procedure, for framing the process, they give misleading signals to lawmakers and practitioners. Adversarial and inquisitorial principles, in particular, if they are used as directive principles, cannot provide adequate guidance anymore, and therefore I would suggest to, at least reduce the use of the notions to its bare minimum as heuristic tools. And modern scholarship of judicial process, both civil and criminal, should phrase new directive approach to procedural principles with a single fundamental principle where activity of all participants is secured. So to show it in a visual way, the procedural obligations today have to be shared among all participants. The content of the obligation is, well, the duty of loyal cooperation, but it creates a process in which values, fundamental values are shared, and these fundamental values of the process are fairness, efficiency, and speed. The methods that have to be used are, well, currently proportionality has come into forefront together with the duty, pre-procedural duty of the participants in the process to undertake all steps that can reduce the disputes or that can clarify particular issues in the pretrial state and therefore even before initiating litigation, there should be a necessity of exchange of information but also claims and necessity of the use of all available means including alternative dispute resolution. And then the conventional procedural principles like orality, writing, publicity, language, assistance, and so on, they are only tools, they are only instruments, and all that together is effectively phrasing the ambit of case management. So that's more or less what I wanted to argue. Thank you very much for your attention, and indeed I'm very open to your question. Thank you.